Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Atypical Depression, Recognition, Diagnosis, and Treatment Options. This enduring material was developed to be distributed on Medscape. Copyright by M2 Communications. This activity is certified by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and presented by Prakash Masand, MD, and Michael Tace, MD. Dr. Masand is a consulting professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences, Duke University Medical Center, Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Masand has made the following disclosures. Consultant for Bristol Myers Squibb, Eli Lilly and Company, Forest Pharmaceuticals, Merck and Company, Pfizer, Sanofi Aventis, and Sunovion Pharmaceuticals, Speakers Bureau for Eli Lilly and Company, Forest Pharmaceuticals, Merck & Company, Pfizer, and Sunovion Pharmaceuticals, Stock Ownership, Orexigen Therapeutics, and Titan Pharmaceuticals. Dr. Tace is a professor of psychiatry, University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dr. Tace has made the following disclosures. Advisor and/or consultant for Alkermes, AstraZeneca, Bristol Myers Squibb Company, Eli Lilly and Company, Day Pharma, Forest Laboratories, Gerson Lehrman Group, GlaxoSmithKline, GuidePoint Global, H. Lundbeck AS, Medavante, Merck & Company, Neuronetics, Novartis, Otsuka, Ortho McNeil Pharmaceuticals, PAMLAB, Pfizer, PGX Health, Shire, Supernus Pharmaceuticals, Takeda, and Transcept Pharmaceuticals, grant support from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, Eli Lilly and Company, Forest Pharmaceuticals, GlaxoSmithKline, the National Institute of Mental Health, Otsuka Pharmaceutical, and Sepracor, Speakers Bureau for AstraZeneca, Bristol Myers Squibb Company, Day Pharmaceutical, Eli Lilly and Company, Merck and Company, and Pfizer, Equity Holdings, Medavante, Royalties, American Psychiatric Foundation, Guilford Publications, Herald House, and W.W. Norton and Company, Spouses Employment, Embryon. Assessment and appropriate diagnosis of major depressive disorder, including subtype recognition, is an important starting point for the eventual management of patients with MDD. The concept of the atypical depressive subtype has been enduring in the literature and is currently included in the DSM-IV-TR. Operationally defined atypical features consist of mood reactivity and two of the following: weight gain or increased appetite, hypersomnia, leaden paralysis, and an enduring pattern of sensitivity to perceived interpersonal rejection. Atypical depression occurs in 20-35% of patients with MDD. Knowledge of the characteristic symptoms of atypical depression and awareness of the efficacy of different antidepressant classes, as well as non-pharmacologic treatment approaches, can optimize treatment outcomes for clinicians who treat patients with major depressive disorder. This activity is supported by Day Pharma. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Welcome to our broadcast, Atypical Depression, Recognition, Diagnosis, and Treatment Options. I'm Dr. Prakash Masand, Consulting Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. And I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Michael Tace, who's Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in Philadelphia. Here are the educational objectives for today's activity. At the end of the broadcast, you should be able to understand the definition, the diagnostic criteria for atypical depression. We're going to take a look at the biological features of atypical depression. We are then going to discuss the clinical trial results of different antidepressant classes in the treatment of atypical depression, and finally, identify non-pharmacological treatment options in the treatment of atypical depression. We want to also acknowledge a grant from Day Pharmaceuticals in support of this CME activity. So let's now take a look at a film that provides a human face to major depression in patients that we treat.
Claire? Oh no. Up now. I swear I'll quit and you'll have to hire a maid of honor.
Adrian.
Oh, I took care of the catering for you. I opted for the beef heart and collard greens. Ew. We need to go shopping.
I hate collard greens.
Yeah, well, it serves you right for not making any of your own wedding decisions. Why do you have this dress?
You should be the one getting married instead of me.
Well, find me a guy as awesome as Adrian and I would. And I wouldn't be depressed about it and have my best friend make all of my wedding decisions for me. Here, wear this. And hurry up. You're late for your fitting, and I promised your mother I'd get you there on time. Put those on. I'm going to be in the car.
I'm trying.
I really am trying. I just don't know what's wrong with me.
Getting married isn't making you happy?
Not really. I mean, I'm so scared of something bad happening, like a tornado or a flash flood.
Well, a wedding is a stressful event. All the decisions, the planning, family pressures, especially for someone like yourself who suffers from clinical depression. We increased your medication after your last visit. Have you noticed any improvement?
It's not working.
Tell me, how are you and your fiancé getting along?
My Uncle Mitch next year on Sharon.
Hey, that could work.
I love it. They're actually both recently single, so maybe it'll be the start of a beautiful relationship.
Okay, all that's left to figure out is where to put Charlie and his boyfriend. Mm-hmm. They're your friends. Where would you like him to sit?
I don't...
We could squeeze him in at Father Thomas's table.
No, I don't think Father Thomas is that progressive. You know, why don't you put them... Why don't you put them...
Hey, relax. It's all under control. I'll figure it out.
It's all just so overwhelming. And I feel like I'm just waiting for everybody to tell me that I'm letting them down.
That's not true.
Have you spoken to my mother recently?
Oh, your mother just wants everything to be perfect. And the truth is, well, you have dropped the ball a few times on her lately.
Are you saying that I'm not pulling my weight?
Oh, look, if you need more help from me, just ask.
No, what I need from you is to be on my side. Okay, and if you can't do that, then maybe... Maybe this is just some big mistake.
Okay, calm down, Claire. I am on your side, okay? I realize there's a lot of pressure on you right now. I'm aware of that. And I'm also aware of your condition, your depression. And I'm okay with that. I still love you. But this is our wedding day we're dealing with here. I want to enjoy it instead of getting into another stupid little fight over nothing. Now, come on. It's time to go see the DJ. Pick out our dance music.
You just called me stupid.
Claire, come on.
No, I want to be alone right now.
But the DJ is waiting for...
No, you hired the DJ, so you deal with the DJ.
Whatever medication your shrink has got you taken, you tell her from me, it isn't working!
And then we didn't speak for 2 days. I mean, is it possible that I'm on the wrong medication?
I never promised you magic in a bottle for your depression. The medication in conjunction with some cognitive behavioral therapy to learn how to manage your stress really should help, along with making certain life changes.
Like calling off the wedding?
Maybe not that big a change. Our time is up for today. Claire, try to enjoy your wedding.
This is our last consultation with Father Thomas.
Should be out of here by 11:30.
I'm in the mood to celebrate. Let's go out to lunch. I'm thinking sushi.
I've been thinking about a lot of things.
You can do Thai if you'd rather.
If it's not the medication, then it has to be my life.
Don't do this. Don't do something you'll regret later.
That's exactly what I'm afraid of.
No. I won't take it.
It isn't working.
I mean, is it? Is it possible that I'm on the wrong medication?
I never promised you magic in a bottle for your depression. The medication, in conjunction with some cognitive behavioral therapy to learn how to manage your stress, really should help, along with making certain life changes.
Like calling off the wedding?
Maybe not that big a change. Our time is up for today. Claire, try to enjoy your wedding. But before you go, why don't we review your symptoms one more time to see if we missed anything? You said before that you weren't enjoying any of this. Claire, this is your wedding. Is it really true that you don't enjoy any of it?
I mean, now that you ask me again, I guess there have been things that I've enjoyed. Even when Adrian proposed to me. And then when I found out that my grandparents would be able to fly in from California, I was so happy.
And you said that you were afraid of a disaster during the ceremony. Let me ask you a few more questions. What are your eating and sleeping patterns like?
That's all I seem to want to do lately is eat and sleep. And you know, when I get up in the morning, I can't get out of bed. It's like my body is made of lead.
You said that your fiancé seems to be rejecting you and this is upsetting you. Is it a possibility, Claire, that you might be overreacting?
No.
Are you sure?
Okay, yeah, in the moment, you know, it really, really feels like Adrian is just totally abandoning me. You know, like, he just doesn't love me at all. But when I go back and, play the conversation in my head, sometimes I wonder if maybe I'm not giving him enough credit. Deep down, I know that I love Adrian. We are so good together, in all the ways that matter. And when I see myself as an old lady, it's with him by my side. I would regret it so much if I lost him because I can't figure myself out.
Claire, I think we may have missed an important part of your diagnosis. You obviously are depressed. But I think you may be suffering from a particular type of depression called atypical depression. Some types of antidepressant medication may be more effective for this type of depression than others. Claire, I think we should change your medication. What do you think?
Take this woman, Claire Simmons, to be your wife. In sickness and in health, in joy and in sorrow, through good times and bad, as long as you both shall live.
I will.
And will you, Claire Simmons, take this man, Adrian Cunningham, to be your husband? In sickness and in health, in joy and in sorrow, through good times and bad, as long as you both shall live.
I will.
With the powers invested in me, I now pronounce you husband and wife. You may now kiss the bride.
That wasn't so painful now, was it?
There's sickness and bad times. You have to stick with me. I have witnesses.
Michael, we saw the film, which puts a human face to this illness of depression, which can be so difficult and agonizing for patients and their families. Any thoughts on the film?
I thought there were really two points that drove home important aspects of atypical depression. The first was her irritability and the mood reactivity, and in particular, her sensitivity to criticism and the reciprocal impact it had on her partner. And it just really, as you said, put a human face on what it's like to suffer from this condition and how it influences others. And then for me, the second important piece was kind of the alternate story about what might have happened differently had her depression been treated differently when it was clear that she wasn't responding to a first-choice antidepressant. Down one path, perhaps the marriage never happens. The other path, a change is made in treatment, and she has the opportunity to get better and follow through with their plans. So I think it's a great introduction for what we're going to talk about today.
You know, you're right, Michael, and I particularly liked the idea of revisiting your diagnosis when things are not going according to plan. That's something that we always tell our colleagues that they should do. If things are not going as expected, is revisit the diagnosis, revisit the treatment. So I'm really excited that we'll have an opportunity to chat about all these aspects. So if I could, Michael, have you speak about the epidemiology of atypical depression.
Sure, Prakash. Let me start out by saying, and I've said this several times before, that I think the term atypical depression is actually a misnomer. Depressions associated with mood reactivity and reverse vegetative symptoms are not uncommon in younger patients, and particularly in younger women. The term was coined, 60 years ago, at a time in which people who thought about depression and who wrote about depression were predominantly inpatient-based, and they seldom saw younger patients with reactive moods and reverse vegetative symptoms. And as this slide highlights, it's not uncommon, it's not atypical, up to a third of depressed outpatients will meet the criteria for this condition, and it is particularly common in younger women with early onset depression.
Michael, what about some of the differences in terms of the symptoms and signs and genetics of atypical versus typical depression?
Sure. Well, it's an early onset illness, so it runs in families. There is some evidence that if you have a first-degree relative who has reverse vegetative features, early onset reverse vegetative features, you're more likely to have it yourself. So it may well be one of the prototypic forms of depressive disorder. I think the two most important epidemiologic features are earlier age of onset and predominance among women. And there may well be something about the biology of sex differences that does promote or increase the likelihood of oversleeping or overeating as classic symptoms. And conversely, as we get older, it becomes harder and harder to oversleep and more likely that when we're suffering with depression, we will lose appetite and lose weight. But atypical depression is otherwise non-discriminatory. It's not confined to people of particular ethnicity or particular employment or years of education, and it really is. It's also seen in men, although not as commonly as in women.
Well, let's take a look at the definition of atypical depression. And as Michael, you pointed out, this is an illness that's been described for more than 50 years. There was a wonderful paper written by William Sargent in the journal Psychosomatics describing what was then called hysteroid dysphoria, which we now probably think was a combination of major depression, panic disorder, and maybe some cluster B personality traits. And what we're going to see today is not much has changed in terms of the description of atypical depression today than was first described by Weston Daly or by William Sargent almost 50 years ago. What they also found was that patients with atypical depression, not only did they have a different symptom profile, but they were better responders to monoamine oxidase inhibitors compared to the tricyclic antidepressants. And as we know, in the late 50s, early 60s, that's what we had to treat depression, the tricyclics, the monoamine oxidase inhibitors. And so there was a differential response to these agents. In more recent years, we obviously use the new generation antidepressants, the SSRIs, the SNRIs, bupropion, and we're going to take a look at how they fit in to the treatment of atypical depression. The other difference between kind of the endogenous melancholic depression that Michael described was much more commonly seen in hospitalized patients, and atypical depression is much more common in outpatients, is the biological profile, the sleep disturbances, the age of onset, as you pointed out, which was earlier in patients with atypical depression. So the Columbia group here in New York really did some of the most pioneering work around the definition of atypical depression. And in fact, when we look at the DSM-IV criteria for major depression, you'll see it's very similar to the criteria put forward by the Columbia group. So these are patients who have mood reactivity, which is considered to be a core symptom, differentiating atypical from typical depression. And then they are supposed to have two out of the following four symptoms: increased sleep, increased appetite or weight gain, a leaden paralysis, a heaviness of the arms and legs, which was described by the lady in the film, and rejection sensitivity, which we also saw in the film, what I like to call a thin emotional skin that these patients have as a lifelong trait, a feature that I think is shared, Michael, with cluster B personality disorders like borderline personality disorder, which is a comorbid axis 2 disorder that you often see in patients with atypical depression. Michael, let me turn to you because I know you have argued as to whether mood reactivity should be a core symptom or sign, or whether it should be an associated symptom or sign like the sleep disturbances or the increased appetite or weight gain. Tell us a little bit about your thinking on mood reactivity and its importance to the criteria.
I think that preservation of mood reactivity, the capacity to lift your mood, is really a proxy for being only mild or moderately ill. The loss of mood reactivity, which is one of the core features of melancholia, is not exactly the same thing as the presence of mood reactivity. I've argued that if you think of the universe, you have your classic prototypic melancholic depressions, and then in the subset of non-melancholic depressions, you have patients who have mood reactivity, a subset of whom have reverse vegetative features. And so I really think it's the rejection sensitivity, not the mood reactivity per se, that is one of the essential criteria. And if I were doing this, I would start out with does not meet criteria for melancholic subtype, and then I would require at least two of the five common associated symptoms.
And so if we look at the criteria in DSM-4, at present is what we have available for diagnosing major depression with atypical features, you see a couple of things. The first thing you see is atypical depression is not restricted to major depression. It can occur in patients with bipolar depression. It can occur in patients with dysthymia. In fact, you know, it's interesting, Michael, if you look at the first reports of seasonal affective disorder by Dr. Rosenthal's group at the NIMH, a lot of those patients had atypical depression, and 80% of them met criteria for bipolar disorder, even though they were described as having seasonal affective disorder. And DSM-4 recognizes it, so you can see that you can have bipolar disorder, major depression, or dysthymia, and still have depression with atypical features. DSM-4 requires mood reactivity to be present in everybody with atypical depression, and then two additional symptoms from a list of four: significant weight gain or increased appetite, increased sleep, leaden paralysis, and interpersonal rejection sensitivity that we saw earlier on in the film. So the next question is, how common is major depression with atypical features today? And STAR-D, which was a large NIMH-funded study looking at major depression and its treatment with different levels of treatment, looked to see how common atypical depression was in the sample, and they found approximately 20% of patients with major depression had atypical depression. And as was described 50 years ago by William Sargent, they tended to be female, they tended to have a younger age of onset, they tended to have comorbid anxiety symptoms and greater symptom severity. So it's nice to know that the illness has not changed much in terms of its description over the last 50 years. So Michael, let's then take a look at the underlying neurobiology of this illness. How is it similar? How is it different?
Well, I think the prominent features are that it's not like melancholia. It's not like classic severe depression. And so you do not see disturbances of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenocortical axis. You don't see changes in rapid eye movement sleep. If you did studies of PET or fMRI, I suspect the condition would look different than classic severe depression. Interestingly, there is evidence from another type of neurophysiologic study that suggests a higher level of non-dominant hemispheric processing, which I think goes along with the kind of being primed for emotional responses that really is at the neurobiologic core of why patients have such rejection sensitivity or sensitivity to criticism. Like other kinds of hypersomnia, individuals will show long sleep time and relatively normal, if not increased, deep sleep, and they don't show the phasic shift of rapid eye movement sleep into the night. So this is different in the sleep lab, different in terms of neuroendocrinology than classic severe depression.
Michael, tell us a little bit about comorbidity in atypical depression. You know, in psychiatry, comorbidity is the rule rather than the exception. What's it in atypical depression?
It's even more so the rule, I think, that it's an early onset condition, and so you see lots of evidence that traits related to dysphoria and rejection sensitivity and sensitivity to criticism coloring the lives of adolescents as they grow into adulthood. And so you see other disorders with early onset, and for example, cluster B and cluster C personality disorders, substance abuse disorders, eating disorders. It's uncommon to see a patient with bona fide atypical depression who has only major depressive disorder with atypical features.
You know, Michael, it's interesting. These more recent studies are so similar to the comorbidity described 50 years ago. The terms were different. They used hysteroid dysphoria, but probably those were patients who had major depression with panic disorder with a cluster B personality disorder that we would call today either histrionic or borderline personality disorder. So the terms may change, but kind of the comorbidity has not much.
Our forefathers in this business were good describers and good writers, and so it is humbling to go back and read some of the descriptions because they're so prescient of what we still see today.
So let's then talk a little bit about, as a clinician, what are some of the tips for the diagnosis of atypical depression? As Michael mentioned, you know, traditionally hospitalized patients at least 30, 40, 50 years ago had endogenous melancholic depression, and that's one of the differential diagnoses of atypical depression. So patients with melancholic depression have pervasive anhedonia. They have a non-reactive mood. They have early morning awakening. They feel worse in the morning. They have a distinct quality to their mood. In contrast to atypical depressives who eat and sleep more than usual, patients with melancholic depression have decreased appetite. They have weight loss. They may have psychomotor retardation or agitation, feelings of guilt. So melancholic depression should be excluded when making a diagnosis of atypical depression. What about some of the other differential diagnoses? Personality disorders could be comorbid, but personality disorders are also in the differential diagnosis, whether it's a cluster B personality disorder or whether it's a cluster C personality disorder. In order to make the diagnosis of atypical depression, mood reactivity is a core symptom or sign, but then you got to have 2 out of 4, either increased sleep, hypersomnia, increased appetite or weight gain. Typically, when we talk about mood reactivity, we say that the patient should feel at least 50% better in the presence of positive emotional events. Patients may have prolonged periods of euthymia if the environment is very positive in some patients with atypical depression. You saw that in the film in terms of the mood reactivity. These patients may have weight gain. A 5 to 10 pound weight gain is clinically significant. They have increased sleep, at least 10 hours of sleep, or 2 hours more than normal is the criteria in DSM-4. They can have a leaden paralysis, a heaviness of the arms and legs that you saw depicted so well in the film that we saw. And then they may have a comorbidity with a cluster B and cluster C personality disorders that may also occur. So these are some of the tips for the diagnosis of atypical depression. So let's then turn our attention, Michael, if we can, to treatments. And let's start off with the class of drugs for which perhaps there's the best evidence base in treating atypical depression, and that's the MAOIs. So tell us a little bit about their role in atypical depression.
Well, in the era in which atypical depression was first described, there was ECT, and then there were the tricyclics and the MAOIs. And what was atypical about atypical depression was the not particularly good response to ECT or tricyclics, but the favorable response to MAOIs. And that was a guidepost for this diagnosis for the first 20 years of, maybe 30 years of psychopharmacology. We have the classic older non-selective irreversible MAOIs, phenylzine, tranexamic, isocarboxazid, and then more recently to try to develop safer MAOIs, compounds that were either reversible or were selective, were introduced and studied. And outside of the U.S., meclobamide is an example of a reversible A-specific MAOI. Seligiline was developed as an irreversible B-selective MAOI. But sadly, I think the best available evidence suggests that neither reversibility nor selectivity in and of themselves replace the older non-selective irreversible MAOIs. And so for selegiline, for example, we need to use non-selective doses to get antidepressant effects. And so there, the effort was put into developing a different delivery system, one that bypasses the gut and the liver. And so that's the origin of the transdermal delivery system for selegiline. By absorbing the medicine through the skin, you can get non-selective concentrations of drug in the brain, so non-selective inhibition, but without having, as we'll talk about in a bit, a high risk for the Cheese reaction, which comes from inhibition of type A monoamine oxidase in the gut.
So, Michael, let's talk a little bit about some of the common side effects of the MAOIs, trinilcypramine, phenelzine, selegiline, and then some of the more uncommon but potentially serious side effects that can occur with these medicines.
Sure. Some of the original non-selective, orally administered MAOIs came from a tradition of development of antihypertensive medications. And so, for example, they can cause blood pressure to lower, particularly with postural change. So dizziness and orthostatic hypotension were common. They can lighten and disrupt sleep, and so you might see daytime drowsiness. They also have anti-adrenergic kind of effects, and so you can see symptoms that look anticholinergic, even though the drugs don't have anticholinergic effects, such as constipation and dry mouth. They also have sympathetically mediated side effects, such as sexual dysfunction, and may lower the central thermostat so that you can see weight gain without actually increased appetite. But those are more on the nuisance side. And the side effect that most people were always so worried about actually come from the inhibition of monoamine oxidase A in the gut. And what that does is it renders your body unable to clear out dietary tyramine. And when dietary tyramine basically touches the sympathetic nervous system, I think it's called splanchnic nervous system, in the gut, there can be a massive release of tyramine. And for sensitive individuals, you can see a 30, 40, 50, 60-point rise in blood pressure. And for folks who might be predisposed to a stroke, that can have lethal implications. And so the dietary restrictions did nothing to prevent the nuisance side effects, but by keeping low levels of dietary tyramine, you could prevent this frightening and potentially lethal side effect. By administering selegiline with a skin patch, you avoid those effects in the gut and also in the liver. We talk about the MAOI diet, and there is no single official MAOI diet. It varies from one expert to another. But I think some of the key elements are that you avoid aged food that has high concentrations of tyramine. And so that includes aged cheeses. It includes various kinds of aged meats. It includes liver, particularly if you were talking about a gravy made with liver, and an occasional oddity, such as the Italian broad bean, the fava bean, is the only vegetable on the list. Food that is rich in yeast or yeast extracts, and certain kinds of soy sauce and other soy concentrates are rich. Many of the cheeses Americans eat are not forbidden. They're actually not aged at all. Most kinds of alcoholic beverages are not on the list, although certain red wines are and draft beer is. And, of course, our depressed patients shouldn't be using a lot of alcohol anyway. Cream cheese, okay. Cottage cheese, okay. Sour cream, not okay. It's generally good to provide for your patient a list of some of the common do's and don'ts and also some options for what to do if a certain food you like is on the list.
Michael, what about some of the potential drug-drug interactions? Because that's another concern that many clinicians rightly have that can lead to a serotonin syndrome or a neuroleptic malignant syndrome-like reaction. What are some of the medicines to avoid?
Well, there are two broad families of drug-drug interactions. One will result in a hypertensive crisis, and this really relates to medications that have sympathomimetic or epinephrine-like side effects. And here, phenylephrine and the epinephrine that's used in local anesthetics is a good example of that. And then some of the tricyclics and bupropion would be on that side of the list. The other major family of drug-drug interactions is also a pharmacodynamic interaction, and that is for serotonin syndrome. And in my clinical experience, this one is you should take much more seriously and will encounter more often than pharmacologically mediated hypertensive crises. And as you know, serotonin syndrome can range on a continuum from mild to life-threatening. But the drugs you worry most about in practice are the SSRIs and SNRIs because we're using MAOIs in a second or third or fourth line position. So patients have been on SSRIs or SNRIs often, and we have to make the transition. Several narcotics are on this list as well. Demerol or meperidine is the one most famous, but in current practice, I think tramadol is the one that you would worry more about, and in part because not just serotonin syndrome, but also the possibility of a hypertensive crisis as well.
Michael, I think you rightly pointed out that interactions with serotonergic agents is something that you commonly can see when you prescribe a lot of MAOIs, which is why the recommendation is for a two-week washout period. If you switch somebody from an MAOI to an SSRI or vice versa, the only exception is fluoxetine or Prozac, which needs a four-week washout period if you switch somebody from Prozac to an MAOI. So that's something important to keep in mind. So let me now review some of the relative efficacy of the different classes of drugs in atypical depression. So Michael spoke about the MAOIs as a class. Let's take a look at MAOIs as a class versus tricyclics as a class. And there have been many meta-analyses that have been published that have found that the MAOIs are superior to the tricyclic antidepressants. The effect size is around 0.27 in terms of superiority. It's a modest difference. But MAOIs have been shown to be superior to the tricyclics in treating atypical depression. Now, many people would argue we never use the tricyclic antidepressants anymore, and that is absolutely true. And so obviously one of the questions that we're going to take a look at is how do the MAOIs compare to the SSRIs, or what's the role of the SNRIs or bupropion in treating patients with atypical depression. But the evidence base of the relative superiority of the MAOIs is to the tricyclic antidepressants, and there have been at least, more than 10 to 12 double-blind randomized controlled trials that have looked at this relative efficacy. Now, what about the SSRIs? What's their role in treating atypical depression? And there have been several double-blind randomized controlled trials comparing SSRIs to tricyclics and even comparing SSRIs to an MAOI. The one that has been compared to is moclobemide that Michael alluded to, which is a reversible inhibitor of monoamine oxidase A. It's not available in the United States, but it's available in Europe and in Canada. And SSRIs have shown efficacy to be similar to tricyclics and even similar to moclobemide in several studies. Although the studies comparing the SSRIs to the MAOIs, for example, the study comparing fluoxetine to phenylzine had 40 patients, comparing it to moclobemide had about 53 patients. And there was a large study comparing sertraline to moclobemide in about 170 patients that also showed similar efficacy. Now, obviously the SSRIs have their own side effect profile, but relatively they have a much more favorable risk-benefit ratio compared to the MAOIs and compared to the tricyclics, which is why both Michael and I would agree that SSRIs should be first-line treatment in atypical depression. And if the patient does not respond to SSRIs after an adequate trial, then one should consider switching them to another class of drugs, whether that class of drugs is bupropion, whether it's the SNRIs, you know, one can debate that. But in terms of the relative efficacy of SSRIs, at least to moclobemide, there doesn't appear to be much different. Now, the common side effects of SSRIs, you're all familiar with GI side effects, whether it be nausea or diarrhea, changes in appetite. Some of them may cause weight gain. Sexual dysfunction is a common side effect of the SSRIs. But by and large, the SSRIs are very well-tolerated medicines and should be considered as first-line treatment in patients with atypical depression. So here you can see kind of the effect sizes of the different classes of drugs that we've spoken about. The largest effect size is for the MAOIs, an effect size of 0.45. The MAOIs, relative to the tricyclics, the effect size is 0.27, and SSRIs relative to moclobemide, the effect size is 0.02, so not much difference. So that's how you would put all these studies in perspective in terms of the different agents. So, Michael, if I could turn to you, let's talk about the role of bupropion. Let's talk about the role of the SNRIs, whether it be venlafaxine or duloxetine, in treating atypical depression.
We've always wondered why the MAOIs were superior to the tricyclics, and it may be because they increase the availability of all three classic biogenic amines, norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine. If that's true, you would think that bupropion, either singly or even added to an SRI, might be a useful medicine. And I think the sad story at the end of 20 years of availability of bupropion is that that was never fully evaluated. What we do know with confidence is that bupropion is a good medication for people who want to avoid sexual side effects, and that you can get gratifying responses in some patients who haven't responded to an SSRI. But we also, as clinicians, think that bupropion's weaker suit was prominent anxiety, or at least specific anxiety symptoms such as panic attacks. And, of course, those are common in atypical depression. You'd likewise think that venlafaxine would have a role here, an SNRI, same with duloxetine. But these have not been systematically or carefully studied. And in one large trial that I was part of, we found no evidence of an advantage for venlafaxine over fluoxetine in the subset of patients who had prominent atypical depression. So I think bupropion SNRIs fall into a treatment hierarchy. They are easier and more familiar than MAOIs. They are alternatives to SSRIs. But the question to you is, should we go 2, 3, 4 trials deep into our first line medications before we go to an MAOI?
You know, and that's an excellent question, Michael, because look at STAR-D, right? So in STAR-D, everybody received citalopram and SSRI at level 1. If they did not respond, they had the option of being switched to wellbutrin or Effexor or cognitive behavior therapy, or being augmented with buspirone or wellbutrin or cognitive behavior therapy. And in level 3, the tricyclic antidepressant showed up, nortriptyline and mirtazapine. That was the switch option in level 3, and the augmentation was lithium and thyroid. And MAOIs showed up for the first time in STAR-D in level 4, where you had the option to switch to tranylcypramine or get a combination of Effexor and mirtazapine Remeron. So, you know, my question is, if we had to design a study just for atypical depression, I would probably move the MAOI to level 3 rather than the level 4, because the tricyclics, we can say with great confidence, are not that efficacious. And maybe after somebody has failed an SSRI and maybe bupropion, as you pointed out, it might be reasonable to try an MAOI rather than go to ECT or go to a tricyclic, or try a second SSRI or a second SNRI. What are your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. And I'd also point out that even though the doctors who participated in STAR-D were good doctors, that they had trouble using tranylcypramine, that the dose was relatively low, the dropout rate was high. And so I think there still is a place for the MAOIs in the 21st century. But if you're going to prescribe them, it's good to get your confidence up, become familiar, because if you can't implement an adequate treatment trial, you probably should be working in consultation with someone else who can. I think being able to do MAOI therapy is still one of the higher arts of clinical psychopharmacology.
And you know, Michael, I think that's a really excellent suggestion. You know, all of us are not comfortable with all the therapies that are available to us, whether it be ECT or deep brain stimulation or repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation or vagal nerve stimulation or MAOIs or clozapine. But there are always colleagues that we have in our community who have a much higher familiarity with it that we could refer these difficult-to-treat patients to, or we could collaborate with them, use them as a resource when using drugs that we have less of a familiarity with. And you know, the other point that you raise is interesting is even in STAR-D, only 100 patients made it to level 4. So, you know, in STAR-D, patients had the choice of choosing what medicines they could be randomized to. So it tells you, even today in a study done recently, there are barriers to the acceptance of MAOIs in terms of the number of patients who were actually treated with trinalcypramine in STAR-D. So here you can see a review, a summary of the evidence base for pharmacotherapy for atypical depression. This is an article that our group recently published. And you can see there are more than 17 double-blind randomized controlled trials comparing MAOIs to tricyclics, SSRIs to MAOIs, SSRIs to tricyclics. And the overall database, again, points out to the MAOIs probably having the best database, but since the SSRIs and bupropion have a better risk-benefit ratio, they should be used before the MAOIs in patients with atypical depression.
Prakash, let me... I think I should point out that since we've talked about seligiline, that there isn't a study of seligiline on this list, that if we're going to use it interchangeably with the older MAOIs in atypical depression, it would be good for there to be such a study. And I did want to, when I presented it a bit earlier, I don't think I said explicitly, I know it was on the slide, but if you are using seligiline transdermal, that the freedom of dietary interactions has only been demonstrated to the FDA's satisfaction at the 6 milligram dose. It's not been demonstrated at the 9 to 12. So if you're using it to avoid the dietary interactions, you're confined to the simple lower dose. And sometimes in practice, we do need to use the higher doses to get the best response.
And I think, Michael, that's an excellent point because the package insert specifically states that the dietary restrictions are not necessary at the 6 milligrams per 24-hour patch, but at 9 and 12, you do need to be concerned about it. You do need to discuss with your patient the list that Michael referred to of foods and drugs. And, you know, I usually kind of give a 3-by-5 card to patients of the foods that should be avoided and foods that are okay, medicines that are avoided with medicines that potentially they could take for a cough or a cold or a fever, because it's always nice to have the options available rather than knowing what's prohibited, because it saves you a couple of phone calls from your patient.
I also often describe what a basal or a throbbing headache feels like, because that is the prototypic or the characteristic headache that is associated with hypertensive crisis. Yeah. It's a pounding at the base of your head, top of your neck headache that is not mistakable with a tension headache or a migraine if you're a sufferer.
Absolutely, and the same for the serotonin syndrome. There are signs and symptoms that you should educate patients about so they know what the serotonin syndrome looks like and what they should be looking for. So let's now turn our attention to another very important class of treatments, which are non-pharmacological treatments, and the evidence base for these treatments in atypical depression. And interestingly enough, there have been several studies looking at cognitive behavior therapy, guided self-help therapy, studies comparing them to the MAOIs, comparing them to each other in patients with atypical depression. And as you can see, there are studies showing that cognitive behavior therapy is efficacious as phenylzine in one study, no different than imipramine in another study. And Michael, I know this is an area that is near and dear to you, the role of CBT in treating major depression. What role do you think they have in treating patients with atypical depression?
Well, I think that that these focused problem-oriented psychotherapies can work well for some patients. And for a patient who is motivated, who's ambivalent or disinterested in taking medication, it should be considered a co-equal alternate choice. You know, obviously you want to monitor outcome and move through treatment hierarchies in the same timely way that you would with a medication. But here maybe an adequate trial is 3 months as opposed to 6 to 8 weeks. But I think that cognitive behavior therapy can be an effective treatment. That was, I think, most clearly shown in Jarrett et al.'s study versus phenelzine. CBT and Nardil were both superior to placebo in that study. So I encourage CBT not to be used as a treatment of last resort, but to be used higher in a treatment algorithm, particularly for patients who are interested in taking that kind of more active, coping-oriented approach as opposed to antidepressant medication.
And of course, Michael, for our most difficult-to-treat patients who don't respond to any individual treatment, we will often use a combination of cognitive behavior therapy with medicines because that's what they may need. And atypical depressives are no different.
And in fact, since they are more likely to be more chronic and treatment-resistant and complicated, they may be in a group that gets more relative benefit from combining treatments compared to doing one or the other. I think the other advantage, psychotherapy costs more in the short run than treatment with a generic antidepressant, particularly if that treatment's given by a primary care provider. But when psychotherapies work, they tend to have more enduring benefit, at least out over a year or two. And for a patient with a chronic and relapsing illness, a treatment with fewer side effects and more enduring benefit should not be overlooked.
Let's then try to summarize what Michael and I have hopefully conveyed to you all, which is that atypical depression is not uncommon. Its prevalence may be between 20 to 30% of all patients with major depression. We've also seen that the illness has not evolved that much over the last 50 years. Even from the first descriptions by William Sargent in 1960, these are patients who have mood reactivity, they have increased sleep, increased appetite, weight gain, a leaden paralysis that they often describe, interpersonal rejection sensitivity, that they may have a mood reactivity, which is considered the core symptom in DSM-4. And then they may have comorbid axis 1 disorders, like anxiety disorders, or comorbid axis 2 disorders, like cluster B or cluster C personality disorders. In terms of treatment, what we've seen is that there are several different classes of drugs that have been studied in atypical depression. Even though the evidence base is the greatest for the monoamine oxidase inhibitors and they've shown superiority to the tricyclics, there is an evidence base for the SSRIs. And given that the SSRIs have a very favorable risk-benefit ratio, both Michael and I agree that SSRIs should be first-line treatment in all patients with atypical depression. If patients do not respond to the SSRI, maybe they should be switched to a bupropion. Maybe you should consider an SNRI. But one thing for sure is you should not deem a patient to be treatment resistant with atypical depression unless you've given them a trial of a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, because they do have a very robust evidence base to support efficacy in atypical depression. And then finally, there is a very important role for cognitive behavior therapy. There are good studies comparing CBT to phenelzine, to imipramine, to other forms of psychotherapies, that they have a very important role either as a substitute for medicines or as an adjunct to medicines in the most treatment-resistant patients. So we have a lot of options available today in managing patients with atypical depression, but I think the most important message is we should not miss the diagnosis. We should revisit it in patients who are not responding to the treatments that we've tried, and we should consider all options in our armamentarium to help patients with this devastating illness. So I want to thank Michael, and we are happy that you joined us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Atypical Depression, Recognition, Diagnosis, and Treatment Options. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features /audio and select the title.